from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, we look at the rise of very realistic-looking fake videos on the Internet. While doctoring videos or images isn't new, these are deceptively realistic, showing people saying things they never said or doing things they never did. These videos, known as deep fakes, have so much potential to distort reality, to influence our elections, sow discord, and much more, that lawmakers fear they're a national security threat. The dangers posed by deepfake videos and what's being done about them, next on Forum after this news. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. As if we didn't already have enough to worry about with Russian bots creating fake social media profiles to sow discord and shape the 2020 election, we now have to worry about very convincing fake videos hitting our feeds where politicians appear to do and say things they never actually did or said. And that's just one of many potential uses for these very realistic deep fake videos, as they're called. And they have national security experts worried that this is a new frontier in misinformation. Joining us to talk about this is Bobby Chesney. He's a professor of law at University of Texas at Austin, also co-author with Danielle Citrin of the paper Deepfakes, a Looming Challenge for Privacy, Democracy, and National Security. Good morning, Bobby Chesney.
Good morning, Mina. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thank you for being here. We're also joined by Hani Farid. He's a professor of computer science at Dartmouth College. Good morning, Hani Farid.
Good morning.
And Hani Farid, just before we started the show, you were mentioning the connections. And of course, this was not in any way pre-planned, but the connections between deepfakes and video on social media and the segment that we just had about the tragedy in New Zealand, the horrific terror attack there.
Yeah, that's right. What we've been seeing over the last almost decade now is the weaponization of the Internet. And that weaponization happens in a lot of ways, whether that's child sexual abuse material, whether that's terrorism and extremism, whether that's misinformation campaigns meant to disrupt global elections or incite violence. And all of this, there's a common theme, which is the failure of the social media companies to deal with the harm on their platforms. And this is, in many ways, I think, sort of one of the defining moments of our generation of how do we have these digital lives when the Facebooks and the YouTubes and the Twitters of the world have refused to deal with the very measurable harm that we are seeing.
And so what they tried to do today, for example, you think is nowhere near what they're capable of doing and should be doing?
There's no question they can be doing more. There's also no question that these are hard problems. But in fairness, they're hard because of the way the Facebooks and the YouTubes have constructed themselves to the tune of billions of users. They have built these systems without guardrails, and now we're going back and trying to fix it. But there are solutions today. I was just reading that this video of the horrific violence keeps popping up on YouTube. We have the technology today to not allow that. And here's how you know that, because copyright infringement material is very effectively and very quickly removed. So why is it that the YouTubes of the world can remove copyright infringement, but they can't remove horrific violence? And the simple answer is because they were getting sued by the movie and music industry when they weren't doing that, and so they got good at it. And they're not getting sued here, and they're not running into the types of problems other than PR problems. So I find it really frustrating when there are known solutions to this and they are simply not being adopted. It is a question of will, not a question of technology.
So it's a question of will. What's motivating it?
You know, you should ask the folks at YouTube and Facebook and Twitter about that. But my view of it is that it's primarily financial. At the end of the day, these are free products, and the way they are monetized is to grab your eyes and grab your data and monetize that. And frankly, taking down content is bad for business. And I think that may be an overly simplistic explanation, but I think it explains a big part of it.
So if social media platforms are not going to remove content, including deepfake videos that are very realistic looking fake videos that make people appear to be doing and saying the things that they actually never did or said, you see this as kind of a perfect storm, it sounds like.
I do think there's a perfect storm happening. We now have the technology to create video and audio of people saying and doing things they never said. We have the ability, as we just saw this morning, to distribute that to the millions of people around the world almost instantaneously. And we have an extremely willing audience, willing to believe the worst in the people that we disagree with. And that is the perfect storm for sowing civil discontent that leads to violence. Think Myanmar, Sri Lanka, Philippines, India in the last year. And disrupting global elections. Think the UK and the US 2 years ago. And so the pieces are in place. And, you know, there are many things we need to do to get to fix this. But one of them is absolutely the social media companies understanding and taking more responsibility for how the platforms are being weaponized.
Well, let's back up a little bit and just explain what deepfake videos are. And what I'd like to do actually is play some audio from a pretty famous deepfake video at this point of a man who appears to be President Obama speaking.
We're entering an era in which our enemies can make it look like anyone is saying anything at any point in time, even if they would never say those things. So, for instance, they could have me say things like, I don't know, Killmonger was right, Ben Carson is in the sunken place, or, how about this, simply, President Trump is a total and complete dip.
So, since that is a video, can you explain what is happening and why somebody viewing this would think it was President Obama?
Yeah. So if you haven't seen it, you should search for this. Search for Jordan Peele, President Obama, and you'll find this video very quickly. And what it is it appears to be President Obama saying President Trump is a complete and utter, and I won't finish that sentence. And what it really is Jordan Peele, who does a very good impersonation of President Obama, speaking. So everything you're hearing is Jordan Peele. And almost everything you're hearing is President Obama. But
everything you're seeing.
Mm-hmm. The part that is new is that the mouth of President Obama has been synthesized by an artificial intelligence system to be consistent with the audio track of Jordan Peele. So Jordan Peele talks. You feed that audio track into an AI system, and it resynthesizes the mouth of President Obama, and then it stitches everything together to make it look like President Obama was saying, well, anything you want. And I don't think it's a stretch of the imagination to see how this can be weaponized. Imagine a video of President Trump saying, I have launched nuclear weapons against North Korea, and that goes viral, and we have global nuclear meltdown in all of 3 minutes. And so this is where the concern is of the weaponization of these technologies. And so at its core, what a deep fake is, and there are many variants of that, and we should talk about that, is an automated system for generating fake content. And you should understand that fake content is not new. We've always had the ability to create fake content, but it has been largely in the hands of state-sponsored actors and Hollywood studios. But now, because the artificial intelligence system is constructing it for you, it is in the hands of the average person on Reddit. Because you can go out and download this code and run it on your laptop and generate fairly compelling fakes. And what I can tell you is every 3 to 6 months, the quality of these fakes is improving at a dramatic and alarming rate. And while there are very cool and fun applications of this, there is also a weaponization of this technology that has many of us very concerned.
Well, what are some of the cool and fun applications of this, Bobby Chesney? And then talk to us about the worry that you have about how they will be used, the weaponized aspect of it. I mean, are there positive uses for deepfakes?
You know, there are. There have long been positive uses for any sort of synthetic media. You can use it for artistic purposes, for political satire, as we, in some sense, just heard. And to give you one very concrete example that was striking to me, there's a company that does audio synthesis called Lyrebird. And my understanding is they have a pro bono program where they are working to be able to give the real voice back to people who suffer from paralysis with ALS. And so there's a medical or lifestyle application there that's very admirable. So there is some benefit, to be sure.
But what is your worry about how it will be used, how this technology and is being used?
Right. So there's a panoply of potential harms, and I'll give you a quick rundown, and my colleague Hani has mentioned a few already.
Yes.
First, staying at the individual level, think about the ways that someone who wishes to harm another person reputationally or emotionally, but especially reputational sabotage, there are ways this could play into sextortion, to forms of domestic abuse, to relationship abuse, but also in the, let's take the business context. Let's say you're competing with someone for a contract or for perhaps a promotion or an initial hiring decision. Unbeknownst to you at any point, Someone puts into the hands of the decision maker a video clip that appears to be you saying something racist, perhaps. You don't get the job. You don't get the contract. You don't get the promotion. You never know why. It's never distributed via a social media platform that, even if they were screening for this sort of thing, they would not be in a position to do anything about it. It's a bespoke sort of sabotage. These sorts of fakes can be attempted now, but the technology that we're talking about here is going to super empower individuals over time to engage in this kind of abuse, and organizations.
And when you say sextortion, you mean, for example, placing you in videos as if you were doing certain sex acts. I mean, doesn't this have some of its roots in, you know, folks trying to basically swap the face of a celebrity, usually women, into porn videos, Hani Farid?
That is one of the early use
Bobby
cases.
Chesney, yes.
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 Yes, I'm sorry. Yes.
So it's easy to see how that could be translated to anybody who has images of themselves anywhere on the internet, essentially.
That's right. There was an early popularization of the name deepfake as a shorthand for this sort of activity. Obviously, there's connotations there, both of the underlying technology of deep learning techniques, but also there's the deep throat sort of sexualized connotation as well.
And so you said, let's first keep this at the individual level. Now, you know, broaden it out for us. What about at the electoral level, the global security level?
Right. One of the strongest and most terrifying use cases would be the use of a deepfake to impact an election, especially if you can drop the deepfake at a point in time when there's relatively little time for the candidate impacted by it to respond and to try to debunk it.
So a couple of days before voting days,
exactly.
Or voting day, or before absentee ballots go out or something like that.
Right. So drop it on a Saturday or Sunday before the big Tuesday election and let it cause what harm it might. So disrupting an election by portraying a candidate in a particularly unflattering or problematic light is clearly something we need to be concerned about. You can imagine all sorts of circumstances in which, say, the local police are in a troubled relationship with the local community and the community's on edge. Perhaps there's been some protesting going on, perhaps some possibility of tipping over into something much worse, and a well-timed and executed deepfake could set the match to the gasoline there. And you can imagine variations of that in overseas military occupation settings. You can imagine it in situations where there's the prospect of war between two sides. There's really no limit to the way you can make already problematic situations worse by clever or fiendish use of this technology.
The other side of this, too, is it actually makes it harder to believe legitimate videos, Hani Farid. I mean, if you do have a legitimate video of somebody doing something illegal, they could say, that's not real. Think about all these deep fake videos that are out there. That's not me.
Think about 2 years ago in the lead up to the national election here in the U.S. We saw an audio recording of then candidate Trump saying some pretty awful things about women. Nobody even thought to say it's fake. They apologized, and they bent over backwards to apologize. A short 2 years later, does anybody think that we would not have been crying fake news in light of the release of that audio? So this just shows you how fast this technology has developed. And I completely agree with everything Bobby said in terms of the potential risks. But in some ways, I think the bigger and the more perverse risk is that everybody has plausible deniability now. Everybody can claim that a video, an image, an audio recording is simply not them. And I will tell you, over the last 3 months, on several times a week now, I've been getting emails from people around the world, primarily elected officials, saying that this video of them in a compromising position, this audio of them saying something insulting, is not real, and please help me figure out that it's fake. Whether it's real or not, I don't know, but it's suddenly, you know, we're going to live in a world where everybody has plausible deniability. And that is going to be very complicated because I don't know how we have democratic elections if we can't agree on basic facts of what's going on in the world.
That is one of the biggest things that so many point to as hurting our country, our ability. It's hurting our ability to come together as a nation and solve problems because we no longer can agree on the basic set of facts. Bobby Chesney, I mean, what are the implications of what we understand as fact and truth, and video being one of the last things that we look to verify? What are the implications of that being gone from us?
There are so many places where we're going to pay a cost here. Just to give one example that comes readily to mind for me as a law professor is what it means for our court processes. Of course, there's always been contestation about the authenticity of evidence that's being admitted at a trial. But by and large, notwithstanding some maybe famous counterexamples, there's a relatively clear path towards using expertise to figure out whether the video evidence that's being displayed or the audio evidence being displayed is in fact accurate. We are now going to get to a place where there may yet be some capacity to detect the modification. And of course, Hani can speak to this better than I can, but it's not going to be so cheap and easy and reasonably available to litigants and jurors as they begin to learn more about the availability of this technology. You could have what is parallel to what they call the CSI effect. I don't know if you've heard of that, but when the CSI TV shows really became popular, litigants found that juries, and prosecutors in particular, found that juries had sometimes very unreasonable expectations about what sort of forensic evidence could be put forward, because that's what they'd been learning outside the courtroom. Now, with deepfakes, as awareness spreads, as Hani warned, this effect of pervasive doubt about authenticity may cause them to start to question even real evidence. And that's going to disrupt the judicial system in a profound way.
Well, you mentioned that there are some ways to detect these videos. And Hani Farid, you also said that this technology has gotten a lot more sophisticated so that these videos look better, but also these tools are easier to use and more widely available. So, I mean, talk to us a little bit about, is the way to detect these videos as easy to use and widely available?
It is not, for a number of reasons. First of all, playing defense is always harder than playing offense. And also, you know, we're outgunned. People in my forensic community are relatively small compared to thousands and thousands of people on the synthesis side. That's number two. And number three is what you should understand about the creation of these deep fakes is it's actually sort of two computer systems. One is synthesizing content, creating the fake, and the other is saying, do I think this is real or not? And they pit themselves against each other. So built into the synthesis engine is the forensic examination. And so you can imagine why my job is really hard now, because every time I develop a forensic technique, my adversary simply folds that into their computer system. The computer system learns what I'm doing, and now you have a very vicious loop that is much, much faster than it's ever been. So think every time we have a new spam filter, if it can immediately, the computer can learn how to bypass it, the spam filters are useless. And so we are struggling, and I will mention that we're also struggling for the first time, and I say this with hesitancy as an academic, that should we be publicizing how we're detecting fakes? Because, you know, the fact is we are academics and our job is to push the scientific frontier, but we also have a very practical and real problem that we have to solve today. And so we in my lab here are really struggling to sort of understand how much information do we release, who do we release it to. We certainly don't want to enable our adversaries further than they already are. And I will tell you that we are working very hard today to get out ahead of the 2020 election for fear of how the deepfakes are going to be used in our upcoming election with the Democratic and potential Republican candidates. And, you know, we are working really hard, but it is a hard problem because the technology for creating these fakes is moving so fast and so rapidly.
Why are you saying Democratic, potentially Republican candidates? Are you thinking that Democratic candidates will be targeted more?
There's just more of them. That's all it is.
Okay.
It's just a bigger pool. Just
because of
pool.
The, you mean
right.
In terms of the president?
That's right.
For president.
Yeah, exactly.
What do you think, Bobby Chesney, about, you know, publicizing the technology that tries to determine whether or not a video is authentic?
Well, Hani's exactly right. The algorithms that could be used to do the detection, once they're in wide enough circulation, then that will be folded into and overcome by the synthesis engines. And so, you know, one path forward may be that we don't make as fast progress on the academic side through the usual open publication of the information. And instead, what we may need to do is, especially when it comes to empowering those social media platforms to be able to detect these modifications, is ensure that labs like Hani's are able to get the best fruits of their efforts in a private way, in a way that then can last at least for a little while into the hands of those platforms. And so at least those broadcast-style deepfake harms can be inhibited somewhat.
And again, we're talking with Bobby Chesney, professor of law at the University of Texas at Austin and co-author of the book, of the paper, Deep Fakes, A Looming Challenge for Privacy, Democracy, and National Security, and Hani Farid, a professor of computer science at Dartmouth College. And I'd like to open our phone lines and ask our listeners to weigh in. We're talking about the rise of deepfake videos, very realistic-looking fake videos, and the dangers they pose. What's your reaction to what you're hearing? What questions or concerns does it raise for you? Do you fear that the next wave of misinformation is deep fakes? Call us at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. Email us, forum@kqed.org, or post your comments on Facebook or Twitter. Just a little bit more, Hani Farid, on how these videos are made. Could you just describe, I'm familiar with the face swapping technology. There's lots of apps where I can, swap my face with my daughter's face and we can be on different bodies. Or, also just on your iPhone, you can attach a unicorn to your face and have the mouth move as you are moving. So this is sort of the basics, right, of deep fake videos. And then they're just much more sophisticated.
Yeah, there's, as Bobby was saying, that there's this catch-all phrase called deep fakes, and it's a bit an unfortunate term because of its roots, but there's really sort of right now three categories of this type of fake or synthesized content. So one is the face swap, and there's some very entertaining applications of that, the ones that you described, but also there's this popular meme on the internet now where people are putting Nick Cage into all kinds of movie clips, and it's very funny and it's relatively harmless. However, that same face swap is what is being used to create non-consensual pornography, where people are splicing in other people's faces into pornography, and so it can also be weaponized. Now, the second type is the lip sync deep fake, which is the Jordan Peele President Obama one, where the video is real of a real person doing something, but the mouth has been synthesized to be consistent with a new audio track, effectively putting words into somebody's mouth. And then the third type is what we call the puppet master or impersonator. And this one in some ways is the most dangerous one because all I need is a single image of you. And then I, the puppet master, sit in front of the computer and the camera and I simply move. I move my mouth, I move my eyes, I move my head, and it animates you in real time to be consistent with the way I'm moving. And now I simply add in an audio track, a synthesized audio track, and now I can create a video of you saying, well, just about anything I want you to say. And all three of these have sort of different types of weaponizations and different types of applications. And as we said at the beginning of the show, there are really sort of interesting and fun and artistic and satirical applications, but we can't ignore the fact that there is a weaponization of this technology and there's a dark side of this technology, and we simply have to think about how we come to grips with that in terms of the forensic side of things, the social media side, and of course the people developing this technology, whether they should be putting safeguards into place to make sure that their technology is not abused.
At this point, it feels like even though this is open source technology, that it is still very hard to create a very flawless deep fake. How far away are we from that? And we just have 20 seconds before the break.
The answer is we're close. And you're right that they're not perfect fakes, but they are very, very good. And I will tell you, every 3 to 6 months, they just keep getting better. And so if we extrapolate, I think we're going to be in trouble before the 2020s.
We'll have more with Dartmouth College Professor of Computer Science Hani Farid and Professor of Law at the University of Texas Bobby Chesney after the break. And we'll get your calls and comments. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. You're listening to Forum. I'm Mina Kim, and we're talking about deep fake videos. Image doctoring is nothing new. Stalin ordered his enemies airbrushed out of official photos, and Cuba doctored images of Fidel Castro to remove its leader's hearing aid. But national security experts are worried about a new frontier in manipulated content called deepfakes. They're deceptively realistic AI-generated videos that use techniques like face swaps, lip syncs, and even digital puppeteers to show people saying things they never said and doing things they never did. We're talking more about the potential dangers dangers of this technology with Bobby Chesney, professor of law at the University of Texas at Austin, and also Hani Farid, a professor of computer science at Dartmouth College. And with you, our listeners, if you want to join the conversation, the number is 866-733-6786. The email address, forum@kqed.org, or you can post your comments on our website, our Facebook page, or on Twitter at KQED Forum. And I'm going to go first to Joe in Oakland. Hi, Joe.
Hi, how are you? Great discussion.
Thanks. Go ahead.
Good. So my question, I guess I'm wondering if it isn't the case that solutions going forward will have to at least include some sort of standard, international standard, maybe a digital stamp on material, video material that news organizations present as actual, where, you know, the onus is on them to sort of be able to indicate that this particular digital stamp could possibly identify at what generation this piece of video, what stage of attention has been given to this video. Is it, you know, maybe it's working closely with video generating Samsung or camera, you know, companies, so you can kind of get some kind of read of what generation you're looking at on a piece of material. And I know it would be something that would have to be a little bit up in the air, but the onus would be on them, and it would relate to their credibility as an agency.
Bobby Chesney, how effective would a digital stamp of authenticity be in terms of trying to curb this?
Certainly digital provenance solutions, where we, in some sense, watermark the original and have a point of comparison to detect when there's been an alteration, I think is an important part of the solution going forward. And there are great strides being made, including some wonderful private sector companies like TruePic, which I believe, Hani, you may be connected with. They're doing a lot of good. The question with those sorts of technologies is, to what extent can we realistically expect the device manufacturers that have the cameras and the microphones that are capturing all this content in the real world, to what extent can we expect them all to take it up, or at least a sizable number of them? It's not costless. And so there are questions about how far we can get if only a few do it, and then looking at it from the point of view of the people who then retransmit, whether it's social media platforms or traditional news media outlets, to what extent can we get them, or will they choose to, insist upon having that kind of digital provenance watermark in the stuff that they then allow to circulate on their networks or that they broadcast, or B, if not insisting upon it, at least boosting or lowering the prominence, or in other ways, flagging the question marks surrounding stuff that doesn't have that kind of watermark. The market may lead us, or may lead some, to do that on its own. If the market won't lead to that place, then the question becomes, should there be a regulatory intervention to drag us to that place?
Yes. So, Hani Farid, how far can we get? How much can we rely on private companies? And how much does the government need to step in?
Yeah. So Joe raises a really interesting point, which is we've been talking about detecting this stuff after the fact, after it's been posted. But as Joe suggested, and as Bobby pointed out nicely, there are what are called control capture systems. And there is one company out there, and for full disclosure, I'm a consultant for them. It's called TruePic. But the basic idea is that instead of using the native camera app, you use a TruePic app. It's a camera app. It just looks like a camera. You can take an image or a video. And at the point of capture, and exactly at the point of capture, you extract a cryptographically signed signature that is unique to what you recorded. You put that on the blockchain, which is an immutable ledger. And then going down the line, you can authenticate that video at the point of capture. And as Bobby said, and he's absolutely right, that this requires a third-party app. So that means when you go to capture something dramatic, you have to remember to open this control capture app and not your native app. Now, of course, that can get built into the camera system. But then also, as Bobby said, then you have to have social media be responsible for looking for that and promoting that. And I think the question of whether this will work or not is going to depend on how bad things get. And I think it's going to be a question of necessity, that as the misinformation campaigns and fake news and the types of horrible things we've been seeing happening over the last few years on this front keep escalating, there is going to be a desire for more authentic and trustworthy news. And I think technologies like this have a very serious place. I don't think they solve all the problems, but I think they take a nice bite out of it.
Well, let me thank Joe for the call and ask you, Bobby Chesney, what laws currently govern the technology?
Well, you know what's funny? Most of what we're talking about in terms of really harmful use of deepfakes, most of this stuff's already illegal in some sense. For example, if we talk about the various ways in which individuals might be harmed with a deepfake, there's a good chance that there's a privacy violation, a fraud violation, various forms of state tort law and criminal law probably apply. So it's not that we don't have prohibitions on the underlying maliciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And from that perspective, you might think, oh, well, okay, then we don't need anything further. But on the other hand, there's a lot to be said for, A, making sure that there are at least some laws that are very specifically about this particular category in order to perhaps enhance the sentences, perhaps simply to draw more attention to the problem and to create more motivation for prosecutors and criminal investigators to deploy resources into pursuing these investigations. And for that matter, to making sure that that's the sort of thing that can happen on the federal level, where the greater forensic capacities of the FBI in particular can be brought to bear more effectively.
Well, I know on the federal level, Hani Farid, Congressman Adam Schiff has asked the intelligence community to look into the issue and let them know if they need new laws or money to deal with the threat. And that last month, Senator Ben Sasse, a Republican of Nebraska, introduced a bill to criminalize some malicious intent associated with deep fakes. Can you talk about what they're trying to do to try to get a handle on all of this?
I will say there's a lot of discussion on Capitol Hill. There's a lot of discussion in Brussels at the EU, and there's a lot of discussions in the UK as well around this issue, and actually and many places around the world, because everybody's worried about their democratic elections. I think we have to have a serious conversation about whether we need to be legislating these issues. I think we have to tread very lightly. I think the legislation, by its very nature, moves slowly. Technology moves very quickly. And so I always, as a technologist, fear that we are legislating for today and not for tomorrow. There are unintended consequences to legislating in the technology space. We have to be exceedingly cautious.
Like what?
You
mean of censorship or?
Yeah. What I would say is one of the concerns I have is if you start legislating now, you will effectively enshrine what is the monopoly of Google, Facebook, and Twitter, because these large companies can deal with legislative pressure. They can deal with having to deal with global issues of different policies around the world. But the small startups and the medium-sized companies will not be able to compete, and you will further squash innovations, which we are very concerned about.
So the better alternative is to do nothing?
No, I don't think it is, but I think you have to tread lightly here. And I will point out, by the way, and Bobby suggested this, and I think he's right, is that most of the harmful content we are talking about is already not allowed by the terms of service of most of the major platforms. So the rules are actually in place already. We don't really need the legislation. What we need legislation for is to force the companies to enforce their rules. So to me, that's the most sensible legislation, to say, look, if you have rules that say you are not allowed to have non-consensual pornography, well, then you are obligated to actually effectively enforce that law. And there should be a duty of care that you are responsible for. You can't write the law and then simply ignore it, or the rule and ignore it. So I'm not a legal scholar, and Bobby should answer this question, but I do think we should just tread lightly. And if it gets to the point where we have to legislate because of the intransigence of the social media, then let's just do it carefully and thoughtfully and make sure that there are no unintended consequences and we have the open and free internet we want, but mitigating the harm that we are seeing.
Do you agree with this notion of tread lightly? And I know that, for example, the Electronic Frontier Foundation has raised the concern that, you know, if you go too far, parody videos, important satire videos, important political statements could get tied up in all of this. Bobby Chesney.
Sure. So, of course, in anything that touches speech, including an area where part of what we're concerned about is the political use of this kind of speech, we obviously need to be respectful of our First Amendment values and careful in that respect. So how does one do that? Well, as Hani said, you know, perhaps one part of the solution here is to create a little more pressure within the social media platforms. And that would involve, and this is a deeply controversial possibility, but that would potentially involve amending the federal statute known as Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act that effectively precludes normal civil litigation against platforms for the content that they distribute.
You mean it doesn't hold them accountable for what they have on their platforms?
Right. And there's many people who would say, look, that has been the thing that's enabled the internet to grow. and for American companies to play such an important role. Don't kill the goose that laid the golden egg. It's certainly possible that we could find modest changes there that could help create slightly different incentives to invest more. But as Hani warned, if you create those incentives and companies have to put in more resources into this sort of screening, the bigger established companies will be in a position to do that and stay in business. It will decrease to some extent the ability of new emerging companies to compete in that same space. So that's a challenge. Separately, perhaps without changing where the legal boundaries are, one could have an increased enforcement effect by surging resources into investigation and prioritization of these types of offenses where, again, a lot of the activity is illegal already or tortious or criminal. It's just very hard to detect it, to find it, and to trace it back to the malicious purveyor. To the extent that we begin to more credibly have law enforcement in particular tracing these instances back, at least when it's persons within the United States that we can effectively get our hands on, then we might get a little bit more deterrent effect than we currently have.
Well, let me go to Dan in Mountain View. Hi, Dan.
Hey.
Hey, go ahead.
I'm here now. Yeah, so I just want to bring up a comment earlier that was made about how YouTube takes video and music down and some of these other sites. I mean, one of the ways the system works, having worked in that area for a while, was you basically have to have known good content, and then you're basically running, you know, a filter against all the uploaded video and audio content and seeing if you get matches. You create what's called a fingerprinting system, and you can, reliably detect what is copyrighted content that way, and that's how those systems work. So in the case of these fake pieces being generated, it's not that easy just to find the fakes, because in general they wouldn't be in your database of copyrighted content. And so, I mean, that's just something to keep in mind as you're getting into the situation of something like Facebook, where you have to have these teams of people just looking for bad content, and there's so much content being uploaded, you'll never be able to catch everything. And so, and one other point was just is the only reason that YouTube and these other people invested in this technology to do this was they were forced by the government as part of the copyright laws that went through. And all the lawsuits, and YouTube was only able to stay in business because they were, got out of these lawsuits because having employed technologies like that. So I do think there's pressure that needs to be put on it, use of technology. Anyway,
I think you have.
I'll take my comment off there.
Thank you. That was an important comment, Hani Farid.
Yeah, Dan's absolutely right. Finding the first content is very difficult. So the video from New Zealand, the first non-consensual porn, that's hard, and that typically requires human moderation because our systems are not good enough. The second, the third, the fourth, and on is easy for exactly the reason Dan said, is that we have fingerprinting technology that can fingerprint a piece of an image or a video or an audio and remove it at the point of upload. We do it, as Dan said, for copyright infringement. We do it for child sexual abuse material. We can do it for terrorism material. We can do it for non-consensual. It doesn't matter what the material is. That technology exists. So the fact that that New Zealand video keeps popping up on YouTube is not a problem of technology. It is a problem of policy and will on the point of YouTube. And it's inexcusable, in my opinion.
Will in Oakland, you're next.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I was listening earlier to how you were saying that this technology is improving every 3 to 6 months. And I'm only 22, so I'm not just thinking about the 2020 election. I'm also thinking about, what this is going to look like in 2040. And I want to know what you guys think, the role of the American education system is going to have to play in educating future generations on how to be aware of this technology and how to recognize it.
Hani Farid.
Man, Will, that's a great question. So first of all, there's a lot of things we need to do to get a grip on our online worlds, and we've talked about a lot of it. But as a professor and as an educator, I'm glad you asked the question. And we absolutely have to educate the next generation of students on how to have digital, to consume digital content. Because the fact is that the way we act online and the way we consume digital material online is simply not working. We have to start understanding that there's a difference between our crazy uncle on Facebook posting an article and reading something on the New York Times or the Washington Post. Those are not the same thing. So digital literacy is going to have to start to become more and more essential. And we're already seeing this rolling out in various parts of the EU where it is being mandated. needed. And my hope is that here in the U.S., we start getting smart about this. We've reached the tipping point in terms of the number of people in the world online. And so now we got to start getting about bringing that back into educational system. And I say that knowing that the systems are already taxed, and asking our education, our public schools to do even more is not fair. But I think this has to be ground zero. And Will is absolutely right. We are worried about 2020, but we really should be worried about 2040. And that means we have to start now for kids who are going to be voting 20 years from now.
It, Bobby Chesney, gets to the responsibility that we have as consumers. If this isn't regulated in any way, where do you see this going? I mean, what kind of society could you envision in terms of trying to address these issues?
Be a little dystopian for a second. Let's think about what may be both a partial solution to some of the greatest threats of this fake information, but also a significant change to our world from a privacy perspective. So if we imagine that 2040 context in which by then the capacity to create the fakes is quite widespread, and the results are way above the eyes and ears test. And people are not going to be able to detect it with their eyes and ears. So if we assume sort of a worst case scenario where this is pervasive, persons who have fragile reputations or valuable reputations, and certainly an elected official who's in the midst of a campaign or somebody who wants to be an elected official is going to fall in that category. They're going to engage in pervasive life logging as a self-defense mechanism. That is, they're going to have wearables capturing audio, video of what they're saying and doing and what all is happening around them at all times, perhaps, as a way to create that, that immutable blockchain-based protective record against which to compare the fakes. Now, if we imagine a world in which everyone has been frightened by a series of high-profile examples of people being harmed by deep fakes, you can imagine as well that companies and others that have business reputations to protect begin requiring maybe first their executives, but then eventually maybe the whole workforce to engage in similar behavior. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, we discover that in order to be able to document what really happened, we document everything. And we go from the current world in which there are a lot of cameras, both fixed and mobile phone cameras, capturing content when you're out and about, even though you didn't mean to be subject to surveillance, to a world in which that just becomes pervasive and ordinary, and anonymity really suffers as a result.
Pervasive life logging. Wow. Steve writes, I like the idea of harnessing a blockchain type of approach with control capture apps to authenticate legitimate media. Videos that don't use it would be suspect, which would help drive manufacturer adoption. Thanks, Steve, for that little glimmer of hope. I'm going to go next to Francis in Oakland. Hi, Francis.
Hi, how are you doing?
Go ahead, Francis.
We have always been on the cutting edge of using cutting-edge technology to affect world affairs, such as the use of Stuxnets and drones. Will we be the first ones to use deepfakes to affect world affairs?
Oof, Hani Farid, this is an interesting question. Also, you work with DARPA on this, don't you? Can you talk a little bit about, I don't know, anything that you can share with us from the Department of Defense? In terms of how they are thinking about this technology?
I will tell you that the U.S. government is very concerned, and not just the U.S., but governments around the world are worried about the weaponization of this technology with respect to national security and democratic elections. I don't know who's going to be first. I'm going to just put it out there. Russia, maybe. I mean, they certainly have a track record of interfering in elections around the world, and they certainly have the ability to do this and the will, it would seem. Where things are going to get really interesting is, are there legitimate uses of using deep fakes to disrupt things happening around the world? I don't know. These are really tricky ethical issues that we're going to have to get a handle on. I'm not the right person to ask that. But I will tell you that here in the EU, in the UK and around the world, people are very concerned about protecting their national security and their democratic elections. And they see this deep fake technology as the new front on information war. And I think there's some real challenges facing us in the coming years.
Well, Jen writes, my husband has been doing visual effects in the film industry for over 20 years, an industry that has been making deepfakes for movies and TV for years, one could say. He can often tell simply by watching a video how it was constructed and if any visual effects were at play, stuff I can totally not see. Have the panelists ever considered working with seasoned visual effects artists to detect these nefarious deepfakes? You're nodding, Hani Farid.
Yeah, we absolutely, John is right that people who are in this business are pretty good at it. I think Bobby said it right, is eventually they're not going to be as good at it because built into the system is this evolution where the fakes get better and better and better. And we know in the limit they're going to reach that limit. But we absolutely talk with people and learn how they detect these things, then try to operationalize that with software.
Well, Hente says, what good is all of this when someone like Donald Trump can simply say something is fake or not and millions of people believe him? We were talking earlier about just what it means when you essentially can no longer believe your own eyes, and in a nation that already struggles to agree on a basic set of facts. I think Hente is underscoring that. Let's go next to Amud in Menlo Park. Hi, Amud.
Hi. I just wanted to say that actually there's another potential solution to this in that, you know, every time we capture a video or create some kind of content, there's lots of devices and all the apps that we've given, you know, permissions to that is recording a ton of, you know, metadata. And so it's totally possible for all this metadata to be corroborated and kind of cross-validated and to determine whether a piece of content is authentic or not. For example, location can be a very good indicator. And so I think very soon we're going to reach a point where unless a piece of content is specifically authenticated, it will be considered to be fake. I think that's where we're approaching that time pretty quickly.
Amud, thanks. Bobby Chesney, location data in terms of using that to discern what's true or not.
It's very valuable. This is a species of the digital providence solution, and I think Connie and I agree that it's one of the key parts of the eventual partial solution that we'll have to this problem. There's a scalability problem, though, that arises in the following sense. So let's say that you're a media organization or a social media platform, and one way or the other, there's some content that's come your way you might retransmit or might allow to upload and be displayed, and you've detected through these means that there's been an alteration. There's alterations and there's alterations. And at some point, you're probably going to have to kick it out to a human analyst to take a look at what is the nature of the apparent alteration and is it of a nature that actually crosses some normative line about which we would not allow. Because there's going to be plenty of alterations that are for aesthetic reasons, if nothing else, that we would not mind. And at that point, if you're a big enough operation, there's only so much content you can screen. So I think scalability looms large as an obstacle here.
Well, let's go next to David in San Francisco. Hi, David.
Oh, yeah, morning. The more I've studied old Roy Cohn, the sidekick to Joe McCarthy, the more I realized that there's profit in paranoia. If you can create a bunch of paranoia, then you can create a lot of profit opportunities, extortion, all sorts of different things, security apparatuses. So Joe McCarthy and Roy Cohn figured out years ago if they came up with a fake, then they could create all sorts of need for lawyers, need for there's profit in paranoia.
Mm.
So looking at this scenario that you're laying out, how can we, you know, back the debt out? How can we reverse the economic profiteering that's coming from, you know, lies as an institution or something?
Huh. David, thank you. Hani Farid, your thoughts on what David's saying?
David raises a good point. There is this sort of core poison that is social media, which is the business model. The business model is not that we pay a monthly fee and we get something in return. The business model is that my personal data is being monetized and my time is being monetized. And so the incentive of the Facebooks and the YouTubes of the world is not to make me an informed citizen. It's not to make the world a better place. It is to keep me on their platform for as long as possible so they can monetize my time and my data. And that creates really perverse incentives. This is why conspiracy videos are promoted at a significantly higher rate than informative content. And that's because people will eat candy every minute of the day instead of broccoli. It's the same issue. And so there is a really perverse economic problem with what is the core of Silicon Valley. And I don't know how to get around that because everybody has come to the expectation that, in fact, this stuff would be free. Now, you can say, look, let people pay a fee. But then you have a socioeconomic divide. People in the lower income brackets are going to have to give up their privacy, while people in the upper income brackets can pay for privacy. That doesn't seem right either. And so I don't know how to fix that really sort of core poison that is social media, which is the underlying economic model.
Well, Pam writes, I think this problem of deep fakes is really emblematic of the era we live in. With the Fyre Festival and the college admissions scandal, people have less and less trust in anything. And that's really frightening. Anita writes, I feel like more and more there's just no substitute for getting off the internet and talking with people in real life and learning how to think critically in general about what's true. We just have a couple minutes left. Bobby Chesney, it sounds like we need several different approaches to really try to get at this problem of deep fakes, but really just the larger problem of what constitutes truth and fact in this country and what sources we can rely on to distribute that.
I think that's right. And, you know, we all look first to education and pray for better media literacy and consuming education, I mean, consuming information smartly. But the fact is we've moved from the Walter Cronkite world of mass market, finite number of relatively homogenous news platforms that could really be trusted at a certain level to make sure that what they're providing to us has been vetted and corroborated and so forth, to a world in which many more viewpoints can be aired, which is great in many ways, but it comes with this built-in cost. There's no curation or limited curation, and when you combine that with our cognitive biases that incline us to tend to want to hear more from people with whom we agree than from others with whom we disagree.
And even see what we want to see. So media literacy, Hani Farid, government intervention, increasing the incentives for tech companies to try to regulate this on their own platforms. Anything else you can leave us with?
I agree with Anita. Get off the internet. Delete Facebook, delete Twitter, turn off autoplay on YouTube, and get out in the world. There is a plague on the online community. Until they can clean it up, get off.
Hani Farid, professor of computer science from Dartmouth College, leaving us with a lot to think about. And Bobby Chesney, professor of law at UT Austin, thank you both this morning for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you to our listeners as well for their incisive questions. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.